We're going to delve into international implementation with examples of circularity in practice. We'll hear from some specific examples from Japan, from South Africa, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Finland. And to kick us off, it's my great pleasure to introduce to the stage our speaker and host for this session, Professor Scott Valentine. While Scott's making his way to the podium, I'll let you know that Scott's an internationally reputed author. He's a professor of entrepreneurship at the University of Brunei, adjunct professor at RMIT in Melbourne, and visiting professor of regenerative planning and circular economy at Kyushu University in Japan. And Scott's the chair of the ACE Hub's advisory board. With over 30 years of diverse international business experience, Scott provides strategic project advice and expert support for circular economy initiatives. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Tina. This is so posh. Last year I had to introduce myself and wash the cups and saucers. So. Good morning, everyone. Let me get set up here. Sophie here somewhere? She said, George Zane in the back. She said to me, Scott, I'd like you to give an overview of the circular economy in Japan, and you've got 8 minutes. That's a problem for me, because those of you who know me know that I can't even give you the time in 8 minutes. I feel compelled to tell you where I bought my watch and, you know, where the watchmaker's kids are going to school and so on. I digress, predictably. Today, I'm going to talk about a project that I've been working on in beautiful Itoshima, Japan. Those of you who were asking earlier, now you know why I moved to Japan. The story is a very interesting story, and it starts with 9 small businesses, and it's going to tell a story, an aspect of the circular economy that I think is often overlooked, and I think it's important to raise this. It starts with these 9 companies. So we've got an essential oil company, a turmeric farm, a cafe that's attached to an organic farm, tomato farm, a sake brewery that has about 150 years of history and that has recently added a bakery and a restaurant, a knitted goods person, a craftsperson, a mask company, a bamboo plantation, and of course, being in Kyushu, the ubiquitous ramen shop. Now, pursuing their own interests, these people are getting along just fine. You know, they're paying their bills, they have regular clientele, and of course they're living in beautiful Itoshima. But imagine if we put all these people together and we take them through a series of discussions around how they can collaboratively improve resource productivity and innovate for mutual benefit. Here's what can happen. So we'll start with the essential oil company that teams up, and it learns that the flour from the turmeric plant, which is often discarded when cultivating turmeric, can be utilized as, of course, feedstock for essential oil. The mask-making company, of course, overhears this conversation and recognizes that infusing essential oil into its masks can appeal and enhance the interest of the masks. It also learns that the leaves, by the way, have an antiseptic property that adds value to the product itself. Next, the mask maker learns that the leaves from the turmeric plant can be ground up and turned into mask-making material. So once again, we have another collaboration emerging. The owner of the sake factory gets excited, because they learn, of course, of the existence of the turmeric farm through these meetings, and they decide that they're going to have dried turmeric for the top of their curry, again, adding a local flavor and a slight bit of competitive advantage to their restaurant operations. Person making the knitwear realizes, well, if we can use, you know, the leaves of the turmeric plant for making masks, we can also do the same thing for knitting sweaters. Imagine that, people all over Itoshima wearing turmeric fabric sweaters in the wintertime. The cafe owner realizes that we can take this dried turmeric, combine it with different spices from different farms around the region, and we can create, you know, spice packs that we can sell. Again, a unique product, a unique addition to the cafe that's in a localized region. Heck, while we're at it, we might as well, you know, see if we can't connect the bake shop. And of course, the bakery is a very interesting bakery at the sake factory because they use a remnant of the brewery process called sake kazu, the fermented rice from the process for making their bagels. So why not sell that in the local cafe? Again, another valuable collaboration. While we're at it, we might as well be selling the knitted goods in the store. We might as well also be reaching out to the plantation owner to see, is it possible that maybe we can use the big sections of bamboo for making coffee cups? So once again, a new collaboration, another competitive advantage, another beneficial localized product. Now, in our brainstorming session, the owner of the tomato farm is feeling left out. And so they note that, you know, they have a number of tomatoes that people don't want to buy because they just look funny. Unfortunately, our world is like that, isn't it? And so they decide, well, the tomatoes are still good. And so off they go to the restaurant. The tomato farmer also learns from its intrepid Canadian facilitator of the session that in Canada they have this wondrous drink. It's called a red eye. You know, with beer and tomato juice combined together, it's both delicious and a wonderful hangover cure. So it's also a very interesting competitive addition to the beer that's being sold at the factory. Tomato farmer also realizes that its leaves, which have a also an antibacterial property to it, can be used as feedstock for the masks. Now, in this process, we also see down here that the ramen factory can now, or store can now come in and play a role, because the ramen store, of course, is just selling pork-based ramen at the time of this discussion. How about tomato ramen, if you've ever had it? Take some fresh tomatoes, a little bit of garlic, add some miso, light miso, put in some noodles, and you've got this fantastic dish for the vegetarian that's lurking in all of us. This idea of cross-selling products in each other's shops gets the sake factory owner thinking a little bit more. Hey, wait a minute. Why not have knitted bottle sleeves for the gifts of sake from our plant? And of course, if you can make coffee cups out of bamboo, you most certainly can make sake cups. Indeed, Japan has a history of doing so. Again, another small product, yet another localized competitive advantage. Now, returning to our ramen shop, imagine if we took the sake kazu, you know, the remnants from the sake vat, mixed it in with the miso, which they indeed do, and then basted it in the pork. Suddenly now you've got a pork ramen product that is completely different than anything else in the market. Come on, admit it. You'd like to try it at least once, right? So, all right. Finally, the bamboo owner, seeing how innovation is begetting innovation, notices that the knitting shop is using woody knitting needles. And just that observation leads them to think, well, wait a minute, we can make bamboo knitting needles. So, boom, eBay, here we come. And then finally, the plantation owner, they realize, well, you know, if the mask can be made from all of this plant material, it can and most certainly often is be made out of bamboo. So now we've got a use for all the shredded bamboo and the shredded remnants of bamboo after they've manufactured whatever else they manufactured with the bamboo. And finally, last but not least, the addition here is, of course, the infamous or the famous takenoko that is ubiquitous. There, I've used that word twice now. I'm getting better at it too. That they use in the ramen. So imagine what we've achieved here. Let's just think about this. Essentially, at the beginning, we had 9 different companies. And before, you know, they didn't know each other. They might have passed each other on the street. They might have even frequented each other's shops. But other than that, all they were doing were selling a relatively mundane, normal array of products and struggling because they had no competitive advantage. What's interesting about their products? Not much. Now, we've got 9 companies that belong to a larger family, a network of companies still able to pursue their own goals, but they're now connected through business relationships that engender innovation and social capital. And moreover, they've also gained a bit of competitive advantage. So that, to me, folks, is what the circular economy is. This discussion that we have about recycling is wonderful, but it's not what the circular economy is intended to achieve, in my opinion. What's really interesting about the entire process to me, and what's most fulfilling about being involved in this process, was watching this group of people go from a sense of unfamiliar discomfort to a sense of community connectedness, to a sense of passion for their community. And you can see from this last picture, you know, suddenly these people are all aware of each other at a different level than they once were. So the circular economy, and this is my conclusion, it centers on circles and it's closing the loop. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's about people and it's about connecting in meaningful ways. And isn't that, you know, what we're trying to rectify, you know, and move away from this industrial machine that has guided the economy for so long? So if you want to hear more about it, we've got a program that's running up in Hume. We've got a briefing session actually tomorrow, so just scan the QR code and come along and join the fun. Okay, so, good God, Linda, that's me. You've gotten me out of the way, so now let's get the star up here. I'd like to introduce from South Africa, Linda Godfrey. Linda is with the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. And Linda, thank you very much for joining us. The podium is yours.
Definitely. Good morning, everybody. I've never had good God Linda used in the same sentence before, so thanks, Scott. Thank you very much, and it's really lovely to be with you this morning. I was asked, I was invited to present this morning. The brief I got was, tell me what is exciting around the circular economy in South Africa. And I could have spent the 8 minutes telling you about the new extended producer responsibility regulations for paper and packaging, e-waste and lighting that came into effect last year. I could tell you about the great work that the National Cleaner Production Center is doing around energy efficiency, materials efficiency, water efficiency in industry. But the lens through which I view the circular economy, as an academic in my previous life, as a research manager now, is one through science, technology, and innovation. And so I wanted to use this opportunity to tell you around some of the great work that is happening in the STI space within our national system of innovation to help transition us to a more circular economy. And maybe some of that has relevance to other countries and to the work that's happening in Australia. So let me jump right in. Who am I? I manage Circular Innovation South Africa. It's an initiative of the South African Department of Science and Innovation, which is a national department, so the equivalent to federal within Australia. And my office essentially guides the strategic direction and investment in circular economy, science, technology, and innovation in South Africa. And the intention is to support our transition to a more circular economy. So there are 4 areas I want to touch on with regards to how the national system of innovation can help advance us towards a circular economy. The first is around unlocking technology opportunities, whether it be new technology development, whether it be localization, or whether it be adaptation. And certainly when it comes to waste management, we're about 30 years behind the global north when it comes to waste technology implementation. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can plug and play technologies in, but with some level of localization or adaptation. So our entry point into the circular economy about a decade ago was through the waste sector. And over the last 8 years, we've been funding R&D in various areas of the waste hierarchy. But a key area has been around unlocking high-value end-use products for waste streams, because the logic is if you can create high-value products, it incentivizes the diversion of waste away from landfill site. And so we've been doing this for 5 priority waste streams. The biggest waste stream generated in South Africa in terms of general waste is agri and agro-processing waste, so your organic fractions. And we've been doing that through investment in biorefinery, things like forestry biomass, agricultural biomass from the maize, sugarcane industry. We have a very large chicken industry, so chicken feather waste, valorization, but also in things like electronic waste, lighting, for example, textile waste. And because a lot of this is government-funded, it's all made publicly available. And I've included the URL for the website. You can go onto it. You can see all of the great research that has been published in this space. And a lot of that has now been taken to market, and I'll reflect on that towards the end. The second one is around evidencing decision-making, a critical role for our universities and science councils to support the public-private sector in doing this. And this takes me into the next part of our journey, which was really around broadening our view and our scope with regards to the circular economy, that it's so much more than just waste management. It's definitely not a synonym for recycling. And so we asked our research community, help us to evidence what the circular economy means for us as a country. Should we even transition to a circular economy? As a developing country, does it make sense for us? And so we've recently published a number of reports that unpack what are the drivers for us as a country. We looked at resource scarcity. Is resource scarcity a driver? Absolutely. We're a strong mining-based economy, but we have a number of critical raw materials that have less than 50 years of economically viable mining remaining. So what happens when we reach end of life? Is climate mitigation a driver? Yes, it is. We've been able to show that just through 3 sectors, circular interventions in 3 sectors, we're able to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions in 2050 to below 2019 values. So we understand our drivers, but now do we understand the opportunities? And there we looked at 7 different resource-intensive sectors to understand what the opportunities are in a circular economy. We looked at agriculture, manufacturing, energy, water. We're a water-scarce country, so how do we drive circular water systems? And we're looking, the 2 remaining studies are human settlements and mobility. But part of the exciting thing around this was also understanding what are the actual interventions, because very often we talk about circular economy in agriculture, but we don't get down to the practical level of what does that mean. So a large part of producing these reports was actually just engaging with stakeholders and making them aware of what do we mean by circular economy in your sector. We also mapped out the current level of implementation of those different interventions and the readiness to implement these various activities. The third area I want to touch on very briefly is around evidencing policy development and implementation. And this is preempting the policy needs of government, whether it be at state or federal or our provincial, national. What is coming over the hill that requires evidence to support it? And 2 examples I want to touch on here. We were the first country in the world to pilot the Pathways model, which if anyone knows the Breaking the Plastic Wave study that mapped the leakage of plastic into global oceans. We piloted the Pew Oxford University to model to understand what should our intervention strategy be for South Africa when it comes to managing plastic. And that report was completed last year, just in time to go into the INC process. And hopefully taking a more systems approach to managing plastic and plastic waste puts us in a more informed position. The second one is one that we're just embarking on now, which is around building circular economy into our nationally determined contributions, the NDCs. And we'll be implementing a project to pilot the new UN's toolbox about building circularity into NDCs. The last point before I wrap up is around supporting business to de-risk and scale circular interventions. And it's really my frustration in that very often academia sits within ivory towers and they do a lot of blue skies research, and a lot of that is just sits on shelves in dissertations and journal papers, and it's never relevant or made available to the private sector, and especially to small business. And so how do we force the hand of academia to work more closely with small businesses? And two examples here. The one on the left-hand side was an initiative out of our biorefinery industry development facility, where essentially we were taking technologies developed by the CSIR, packaging them for business and partnering with SMEs that would then commercialize and take those businesses to market. And the second initiative is our Circular Economy Demonstration Fund that we launched this year, which really is around forcing academia and business to work more closely together, where we've essentially said to business, where do you need access to bright minds, to infrastructure, to laboratories in our universities to help you scale and de-risk your business activities? And we're funding bringing academia and business together to help scale and de-risk. So my concluding thoughts, really, I think the exciting thing about a circular economy, and we heard that yesterday, we've heard it this morning, is the circular economy calls for disruption. And it calls for innovation. And in both of those, there is an opportunity to harness universities and science councils, to harness our national system of innovation to support that change. Our universities and science councils have an incredibly important role to play in evidencing our transition, de-risking these solutions, and developing new innovative approaches to the circular economy. And lastly, is that we need the strategic guidance. I was surprised yesterday with the colleagues who said, you know, it's not so much an issue that we don't have harmony between the different states, because I do believe that at a national level, there needs to be the strategic direction, the guidance, both in terms of funding and the opportunities and what we should be investing our STI in to make sure that we're doing the right research, that we're developing the right technologies, that we're driving the right innovation. And I think certainly without having done that in South Africa, we would have a very ad hoc approach within our universities and science councils with regards to this. So it requires partnerships, it requires working together, and really I think it's exciting in terms of how do we unlock and harness the opportunity of our national system of innovation. Thank you very much.
Great. We're going to have a chat. But before that, we're going to have some videos.
My name is Thomas Korbeyer. I'm the chairman of the government-appointed delegation for a circular economy in Sweden. I have a mixed background from industry, from environmental NGOs, from public administration as director of the National Energy Agency, and from a major power company. The delegation is made up of people with different backgrounds. We have a director from Coca-Cola. We have a director from a secondhand shop chain, people from the automotive industry, and another professor. Originally, our task was to advise the government, but we have been increasingly asked and instructed also to help industry developing circular solutions and industrial symbiosis. In Sweden, one of the important perspectives on circularity is that we not only look at societal circulation of materials, but also look how these are integrated in the natural cycles of materials around us. And that's quite important to prioritize what are important circularity targets for society. Sweden's success in circularity is very much in the material and energy area, where we learn to cascade use resources in a rather efficient way. Most easily, we saw the importance of cogeneration of electricity and heat. If you burn an expensive fuel to produce electricity, you should also make use of the heat. And we do so with district heating systems in all our cities, where this heat is paid for by house owners who get their houses heated instead of burning fuels locally. But why use expensive fossil fuels? Residues from the forest industry and agriculture is increasingly used in Sweden, or almost entirely for electricity generation and district heating. And when you do so, you can not only use the direct residues from forest and agriculture, you can also use household waste, if sorted properly, so that it is a suitable fuel. And then the owners of these cogeneration plants are paid to receive the fuel, paid for the electricity they produce, and paid for the cooling water that they sell for heating houses. When that electricity produced is used in industry, that is not energy consumed. the electricity may be consumed and converted into heat, and that heat again as industrial waste heat can be used in district heating systems for dryers and even for greenhouses. In Sweden, there are examples where waste heat from server halls are used in greenhouses to produce tomatoes during the cold Swedish winter. Well, I know not all countries in the world need as much heat, and some have more than they need, and so do we, especially in the cities in the summers. And we learn to develop technologies to use cheap industrial waste heat in the summer to produce cooling. Those machines are called absorption heat pumps, and they work very well in practice, and you can understand them with a bit of training in thermodynamics. But burning biomass and waste produce CO2. It's not much of an environmental problem in a country where the forests grow faster than they are cut, and that CO2 is taken up by the forest, but it's still a waste of a resource. The concentrated CO2 released from big smokestacks can be utilized again. In Örnsköldsvik in northern Sweden, the CO2 from a cogeneration plant fueled with biomass is combined with hydrogen from fossil-free wind and hydropower to produce methanol as a shipping fuel. This plant is still under construction, and the whole project is now owned by a company also developing offshore wind power. And this, I think, will be an important issue for the future. If we are not using fossil fuels, we need to take care of the carbon atoms that we have in society. That is an exciting issue for the future of a circular economy. Thank you.
My name is Anne Vasara. I am the Ambassador for Circular Economy and Green Transition at the Ministry for Foreign Affairs of Finland. Thank you for the opportunity to speak at the Circularity 2023. Finland scores high in many international sustainability comparisons. We are close to reaching many of the sustainable development goals, but there is still way to go for the environmental ones. Finland has an ambitious climate policy target of carbon neutrality by 2035. Here, circular economy transition is needed as an important accelerator. To tackle challenges in cutting back raw material use and to improve our circularity rate, the Finnish government made a decision on a strategic program to promote a circular economy. We were among the first to set targets to curb domestic use of natural resources. This strategy is a result of extensive collaboration and co-creation of all the key players in circular economy, with inclusive consultations ranging from ordinary citizens to scientific experts. Now, how do we walk the talk? I will give three examples from the national program. First, National Green Deal for the circular economy with key players. The key public and private actors have joined in developing a voluntary Green Deal that will lead to a low-carbon circular economy by 2035. The participating organizations set goals and define effective measures to achieve the goals based on extensive scenario work led by research institutes and participation of ministries, businesses, and municipalities. Second example, the circular design training program for companies. This is a one-year-long deep dive into circular design principles for companies' strategic management and operations at the same time. Participation from different functions and hierarchical levels creates similar understanding and integration of circular economy thinking. New strategic thinking bends the value chain to value networks, and new circular product and service concepts are developed. Third example, circular economy is integrated into our education system at all levels. However, many of the pioneers have gained their knowledge with learning by doing. The system to certify these skills is currently under construction. A word on mining, since Finland as well as Australia are countries with an intense mining sector. The mining sector has a key role in developing circular economy in Finland because mining and quarrying alone generate 75% of waste annually. Circular innovations are also important in solving the significant shortage of minerals required for the green transition. The cross-sectoral mining cluster also promotes other green innovations, for instance, a responsible EV battery value chain from mines to battery chemicals and efficient battery recycling process. International cooperation and sharing best practices is vital in making circular economy the leading economy model globally. Since 2017, Finland has invited partners interested in the transition towards sustainable circular economy to participate in a shared global platform, the World Circular Economy Forum, to exchange ideas, share experiences, and build networks. We look forward to working together to promote circular economy and to reduce our impact on the global environment. Thank you.
Friends, my name is Freek van Eyck. I'm the CEO of Holland Circular Hotspot. In both Australia and the Netherlands, there is a tremendous momentum for circular economy. We see it as a necessity, but also as a business opportunity of the century. We also know that this is a transition that we cannot tackle alone. In 2019, witnessed by our Prime Minister Rutte, Planet Ark and Holland Circular Hotspot joined forces to accelerate the circular economy. Some of the highlights that come to my mind are the 2020 manufacturing partnership between Integra and Brink Industrial, my dear friend Johan Prommel, international advisor's visit to discuss sustainable procurement, key topic according to me. We've seen Dutch companies building next generation waste management systems in Australia. There's a growing academic collaboration involving at least 5 Australian universities, a visit by former minister and Professor Jacqueline Kramer to Australia in 2022, who all of a sudden made very complex circular transitions in the built environment and textile seem quite approachable. And it's with great pleasure that I think back of the visit of our Australian and New Zealand friends in 2023 to the Netherlands. Now, these examples showcase our ongoing commitment to sustainability despite global and national challenges. And we are just getting started. Looking ahead, we see even more opportunities for collaboration. We will continue to share experiences in the field of circular finance, business, government, academic collaborations, circular procurement, and circular policies. We are eager to learn from you about reporting and metrics, building upon First Nations knowledge, connecting social enterprises and circularity. We want to promote behavior change. And we should continue to collaborate in key sectors such as textiles, footwear, buildings and construction, agriculture. By making circular economy explicit for a sector, we can make it actionable. Urgent societal challenges require international collaboration in new sectors such as water, critical raw minerals, and hydrogen, topics of mutual interest and complementary capabilities. But what's new? I share with you the lessons I learned while working in the international field with other circular economy hubs. While the circular economy deeply relies on local and grassroots action, none of us can operate within the planetary boundaries if we don't think of it from a global perspective. We are deeply interconnected, and by working together, we can put our connections to good use. The time is now to align thinking, to think in systems, and align actions at regional, national, and international level. Based on the success of the first 4 years, there is no doubt that Australia and the Netherlands can continue to lead the way in a transition to a circular economy. I'm looking very much forward to team up with you, looking even more forward to be among you soon. Thank you and have a successful conference.
Okay, I may be misinterpreting this, but I believe that Tina said that we're canceling coffee and that we can go till 11 or something like that. No, we are just postponing coffee a bit, so please don't panic. We'll just have a 5-minute wrap-up. And, Linda has come so far. Rather than having kind of a chat, I'd like to hear a little bit more about, how you're aligning industry and government interface to foster a circular economy. And one of the things that came up in discussions yesterday was an interesting contrast that we in Australia see as a barrier to SME development, which is that in universities, as you all know, you know, we've got these collaborative research funds, which is great in that they're, you know, they're matching funds and they allow you to, you know, maximize your impact if you're a larger organization. But if you're a small business owner, it's really hard to find the money to, you know, invest in that research. I'm just wondering, maybe you can share what we were speaking about yesterday.
Yeah, sure.
in South Africa. Yeah.
Well, first of all, apologies, because it sounds like my fault that tea's been delayed now. But but yeah, you're absolutely right in that. And I think it also came up in the report that was released yesterday around the Australian Circular Economy and Business Study, which showed that one of the biggest obstacles, especially for small businesses in adopting circular practices, is the lack of funding to be able to do that, lack of access to capital. And so it was, when we did our studies in terms of understanding the opportunities within a circular economy, it came up as an obstacle there. But what we also realized is that the circular economy is not new to us, as I think to many developing countries. It's very deeply entrenched in existing practices and probably driven more by need than by policy design. Things like poverty, unemployment that drives refurbishment, repair, reuse, more regenerative practices. And so the question was, how do we support these small businesses to move them either out of informality or to help them, or to move them out of informality and to scale? Because we've got all of these activities, but we are not yet achieving the scale for meaningful impact. And if we're going to transition to a circular economy, we don't have the luxury of time. We need to move fast on these issues. But yet we have all of these bright minds, we have all of this infrastructure sitting within our universities and science councils, and how do we make that more relevant to small businesses? How do we partner them together? Because I think very often academia or the research community doesn't necessarily know what business needs, and sometimes business doesn't know how to ask the right questions to get what they need from universities or science councils, or even how they can fund those kinds of things. And so government sort of stepped in, our Department of Science and Innovation stepped in to say, we'll help broker that relationship. Small businesses, you tell us what it is that you need, and we've got a network of around about 150 researchers, academics working in the circular economy space, and then we look to partner small business with the relevant institution. But for a short period of time, it's not meant to be blue skies research. We're not interested in how many journal papers come out of it, how many dissertations come out of it. We're wanting to drive short-term impact to help them to de-risk, help them to scale, and very, very importantly, is the demonstration part. So every single project needs to have an awareness component to it. We want people to come and look, to see, to feel. I don't know if it's just an African thing, but we're very anxious around, you know, taking on new initiatives unless we've been able to feel, touch it, smell it. And so these demonstration projects allow for other small businesses, people from government, to come along and have a look at what is happening and to help de-risk that, that we can start to replicate these initiatives around the country.
Great. Thank you. Do I have time for one more? No?
Short one.
Short one? Sure. Okay. All right.
Short answer.
In Japan, one of the issues, and you know, we're talking about the importance of recycling as a foundation for the circular economy, it's true. In Japan, one of the problems, they've got this extended producer take-back scheme for appliances, and it's worked wonderfully. Over 90% recycling rate for appliances, major appliances in Japan. What it's done is it's gutted the repair industry. So people are just simply swapping out their refrigerators. And how do you avoid these types of problems in South Africa? Is it because, I mean, you know, you've got communities that are dependent on upvaluing much of their resources. How do you avoid the recycling industry taking all of these resources from them?
Yeah. Oh, it's a loaded question, that one, and a very short answer.
Yeah.
So especially when it comes to waste electrical and electronic equipment, what was so fantastic in the development of the response to our e-waste extended producer responsibility was essentially a four-tier hierarchy system of saying we recognize that there are a lot of people working in informality, repairing especially white goods, and how do we ensure that they are integrated into the EPR response? Because we could just pretend that they're not there. We could just marginalize, sideline them in the process and go with a more formal approach. But for many people working in informality, this is their only source of income. It's their only livelihood. And so there is this four-tier approach of saying we need to integrate all within the process. And I think just recognizing the role that they play of including them in the process, I think is half the battle won.
Mm, great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your perseverance, everyone. It is indeed coffee time now. Linda will be around all day today, won't you? So please pull her aside if you have a chance to chat with her, hear a little bit more about what CSIR is doing. So thank you, Tina.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much to Scott and Linda and to our video sessions that were presented today. It's wonderful to hear the experiences that can inspire us in our own work here in Australia.